The advice and recommendations in this program are for general education purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional before beginning or changing any course of health treatment.
This is House Calls with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email housecall@cfra.com or text us at 580-580. Now, here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good morning and welcome to edition number 916 of House Calls for this March the 3rd, 2024. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. We're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk 580 CFRA here in Ottawa and taking your call shortly at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number, and your comments and questions at 580-580-580-580. And when we talk about the air that we breathe, we have to be careful in Toronto, Peel region, Brantford, Hamilton, Waterloo, Montreal, many cities in Europe. Measles is making a resurgence. I talked about this last week, but the story is not going to go away. There are more and more reports of outbreaks as vaccination rates continue to be too low to be able to prevent the spread. If you are vaccinated, you are protected. So that's the key thing. If you had your two doses, especially for your children, if they've had their two doses of measles vaccine, usually given at a year of age and then at 4 years of age, if they've had that, they are just fine. If your child has had one dose only and only 79% of all children 7 years of age or younger have had only one dose of measles vaccine, so they are more at risk of contracting measles. And then for those that are unvaccinated, they're pretty much guaranteed of contracting measles if they are exposed to the virus. It is a neurological disease. It can cause harm to the brain, to the lungs, to your hearing, cognitive processes. There is even a delayed neurological disease that happens about 7 years after contracting the infection. So it is not innocuous. And as I said, I talked about it last week, so I'm not going to push it that much more, just to let you know that there are many more headlines coming out now. One, measles on the doorstep of Waterloo region due to reduced immunization. Another is measles are back, blame complacency. That was by Dr. Chris Labos, published in the Ottawa Citizen. And measles may be spreading in some Canadian communities, officials warn. That's from CBC News. I wanted to turn also to, as you know, I like to focus on evidence and and critical thinking, especially when it comes to people or companies or individuals that are trying to take advantage of people that are desperate, vulnerable, have illnesses, want to be healthy, and where medical science hasn't caught up yet with the treatments for these specific conditions because more research is required. There's always more to learn. There's always more that can be done. And we're seeing this now happen with the advent of artificial intelligence to be able to rapidly cycle through different medications that might be candidates for treatments. And DNA technology and using CRISPR, which is a means of gene editing. We've already seen essentially a cure for sickle cell anemia by taking out the defective gene that causes sickle cell anemia and in putting back in the proper gene, and it reverses the whole process. So there are some exciting things that are happening, but it can be slow and it can be frustrating for people when that happens. And so into the void steps all kinds of peddlers and charlatans who try to use buzzwords. And it's interesting how they will use scientific words, even though they tend to downplay the science, to make them sound legitimate. And one of these, again, published by Dr. Joe Schwartz, he's a local hero of mine in Montreal. He's the director for the McGill Office of Science and Society. I took his courses in chemistry way back in 1981. And at McGill, and he writes along with his team of science writers about different things in medicine and in science. And one is an article called "The Reprenizer Merits Reproach." This reprenizer looks like a hairdryer. If you go to their site, the McGill Office for Science and Society, if you go to their site, you'll see a picture of it. It really does look like a hairdryer, but they say that it is a device to bioprogram hair. That's a quote, bioprogram hair, all for $1,200, right? It's a Lumielina is a Japanese manufacturer, claims that it does more than just dry your hair. It says it does not damage hair like a hairdryer and improves the quality of hair with each use. Now, you have to forgive me on this, but I just want to give an example of what is on their website and what they say about what's behind the process of this. And if your head is not spinning at the end of this, it takes a lot to make your head spin. So this is what they said. This is word for word. The ceramics in the reprenizer are programmed with a field which calculates the fundamental physics theory of space-time. It is thought that the energy of elementary particles is stored in vacuums that exist in atoms, molecules, and nuclei. This system in nature, where the micro world dominates the macro world, is called the hierarchical structure. This hierarchical structure is made up of fields. If you want to know the true state of nature, it is necessary to think and calculate in terms of quantum mechanics. It is theoretically clarified by Einstein's discovery of special theory of relativity that time decelerates as speed increases, and from the general theory of relativity, time accelerates as the influence of gravity decreases, or time decelerates as gravity increases. That's on their website for a device that they call the reprenizer. And they go on to talk about their theoretical physics of space-time, that if one programs a field of matter, it becomes possible to derive new, never-before-discovered functions which were innate in their respective forms of matter. And the gobbledygook goes on and on. This is a word salad of scientific words that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And they make claims about how this actually works. So Dr. Schwartz actually went to look for the patent for this. You want to see, okay, well, if you're saying quantum mechanics makes your hair better and restores your hair, is there a patent for it? So he said there was a patent. It was U.S. patent D832509S1. Did it tell him about quantum mechanics and how it applies to Einstein's theory applies to a hairdryer? No. In fact, the patent stated that it was for a hairdryer, despite all the advertising that proclaimed the reprenizer to be far more than that. So the patent was about the design of its shape, not its workings. And so although it looks like a hairdryer, blows hot air like a hairdryer, and is used like a hairdryer, It's a hairdryer for $1,200. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. We'll be back with your calls and questions in just a couple of minutes. Talk 528-255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number, and your comments and questions at 580-580. You're listening to House Calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. I wanted to get to a comment because this was last week as well. It was Mark asked about symptoms that would suspect MS. MS tends to happen maybe late teens, but more in the 20s, between 20 and 50 years of age, but tends to appear in younger people. The most common signs and symptoms are sensory changes as well. So sensory changes in the limbs, feeling numbness, tingling, motor problems, so having difficulty walking, visual losses. And in terms of percentages, the sensory loss in limbs, about 31% of the time, those are the symptoms you see with MS. Visual loss is about 16%, motor difficulties, 9%, eyelids that are drooping, 7%, gait disturbances, also there, 5%, balance problems, dizziness, that can be bladder problems, spastic movement of the limbs. Those are some of the things you would see with MS, and you tend to get a conglomeration of that occurs suddenly. Right, it's an attack that happens, and you usually would want to investigate that. Usually, do MRIs or CTs, and sometimes spinal tap as well. So that's sort of the symptoms that would make you suspect MS when you see these conglomeration of neurological symptoms that occur together. There are many things that can do that. But in the process, you are looking at MS as a potential diagnosis, and there are then tests that follow. Usually when you do the scans, the brain scans, you'll see small plaques and you'll see things that change in the spine, the spinal cord, that can indicate, and in the brain that can indicate that MS is actually occurring. So there is a way to diagnose that. There are different types of MS, different types of presentations of it in terms of whether it relapses or remits or as progresses, there's a whole bunch of different types. But that being said, those are the most common symptoms and signs: sensory problems in the limbs, visual loss, motor problems, so movement, droopy eyelids, unsteady gait, balance problems, sensory changes in the face, sometimes pain as well, bladder problems, vertigo. Those are sort of the things that you look at. So I hope that was a bit helpful for you, Mark. We're going to go to line one and speak to Dennis in Armprior. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. Last summer, I started getting cold sores on my lips, and I thought, that's strange. Mm-hmm. And I didn't pay much attention to it. And finally, I thought, well, I better call my doctor and go see. And he said, do you have a virus, Dennis? He says, some sort of a herpes-type virus.
Right.
And I thought, well, I'm a recent widower. I haven't had any sexual contact with anybody, and that sounds awful. He says, well, we'll get for you a prescription of Zovirax cream.
Right.
Which I was on for a couple of months. All it did was just kept the pain away. Then he put me on Valacyclovir, Clover, 500 milligrams.
Right.
I went on a 2-a-day for 10 days, and it almost cleared it. And then we kept going. I went through 28 tubes of Zovirax last year. As of last Sunday, I finished 30 days of Valacyclovir, Clover, 500 milligrams, twice a day. And it was almost gone last Sunday, and I was out. My prescription was done. And I thought, oh, okay, the cream will just finish it for the week. Well, no way. It came right back big time. So I'm going to have to get some more. But my question is there anything else that I can do?
One of the things from Richard describing is it might not be herpes simplex.
Oh.
Because it usually runs a specific course, usually only lasts about 7 to 10 days and then disappears and would disappear on its own because of the life cycle of the virus. Herpes simplex, there's two different types when we talk about herpes. There's type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is generally determined to be non-sexually transmitted. It appears on the lips, usually kissing someone, in contact with someone. Someone touches their lips, touches your hands. You bring your hands to your face. You can catch it like that. It can be transmitted sexually, but a lot of times type 1 is not sexually transmitted. Type 2 is a sexually transmitted version of herpes. So there are two different types, but herpes infections, the way they work, the virus infects the skin. It reproduces in the skin. So it has a reproduction cycle of about 3 days or so. That's why when you use the medication, when you start to feel tingling on your skin or some pain and there's no rash yet, you don't see any of the bubbles or the vesicles.
Mm-hmm.
That tells you that the virus is already starting, and the medication interferes with how the virus can reproduce itself. And if that's done within the first 72 hours of an infection, you will minimize that reproduction of the virus, so you'll minimize the damage to the skin. After those 3 days, the virus is pretty much done. The damage is done. And then the body attacks the virus. It destroys it. And then you end up, it can lie dormant for a while, but the damage heals up usually over the next 10 to 14 days. So if you have something that is persisting despite the use of these medications, first off, using the medication for 30 days would, because of what I've just mentioned, that the virus has a 3-day replication cycle, taking it for 30 days is way past the 3 days. The virus just doesn't do that for 30 days.
Hmm.
Unless somebody is immunocompromised, right? So someone that has no immune system, they get a viral infection and the virus runs rampant because there's nothing to stop it. So there are caveats to that, but that's not your situation. I'm making that assumption, but I'm sure that's not your situation.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, if you have something that's persisting, then the next step would be for your physician to take a photo of what this is, and they can send this photo by an electronic consult to a dermatologist to look at that and give other differential diagnoses of what this is. Because something, again, that's going on for 30 days with all the antivirals that you've been using, it's not walking like a duck.
It's got
to be something else.
Okay. Yeah. So for sure, like it was almost gone last Sunday, but that was after 30 days.
Yeah.
And it was gone in November. November, for the first time, it was hallelujah.
Mm-hmm.
It was gone. And then mid-December, I was meditating, as a matter of fact.
Right.
And I finished meditating, and I could just feel this pop on my lip. And I thought, son of a gun, it's back.
Right.
And there it is.
Yeah, so I would, again, for something, now that part of it sounds like what herpes would do, but the duration of time just doesn't match what we tend to see with it. It just doesn't seem to, it shouldn't last that long. You know, when we look at the infections, I'm just looking here. In primary infection, clinical illness occurs 2 to 12 days after exposure, and recurrent infections can happen in 20 to 40% of people. But again, it doesn't normally last. See, recurrent lesions progress from vesicle to crust in 5 to 8 days. in the absence of any medication. And so it just gets better on its own. So again, something that's going for 30 days, something else is up. You may be getting a herpes infection that then goes away, but it may be predisposing you to another type of infection that follows because the skin is getting damaged. So potentially...
Oh, it's pretty nasty looking. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would have this looked at because again, 30 days is, I mean, all things are possible. Whether it's probable is the question. It's not very probable that it's going to last that long, 30 days, when it has a characteristic natural history where it shouldn't really go on for that long.
Right. 72 hours should do her, and that should be the end of it.
Well, 72 hours is when you have that window to treat in the first 72 hours. And then you still have a bit of a rash and you still have some discomfort, but you don't have the same extent of the infection because it reduces it. And then it usually will go away after about 10 days or so, 10 to 14 days. So something that persists where you have that rash that's not going away for 30 days, it just raises a flag to me to say, well, maybe, you know, we shouldn't make just the assumption that it's herpes. It might be, but it could be something else in conjunction with it.
Photo to a dermatologist. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Bye now.
Okay, take a small break and get to your calls and questions. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to House Calls. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Let's begin.
Peter Pumpkinhead came to town, spreading wisdom and cash around.
The advice and recommendations in this program are for general education purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional before beginning or changing any course of health treatment.
Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin and House Calls on News Talk 580 CFRA. Reach the doctor right now at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or text him at 580-580.
House Calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long distance number. And your comments and questions at 580-580. Very quickly, Roberta from Hinterberg said that after a routine mammogram, they found a dark shape in my left breast, and now I'm being sent to the general hospital as they have a machine that Hampton Park does not have, and I have to wait weeks because of a backlog. If it was cancer, would I be seen sooner? So, Roberta, this is a very common procedure that is done. That doesn't mean that you necessarily have cancer. In fact, many times that's not what happens, but there are devices or imaging devices that will do a much more narrow view. That is, they'll go right down to the area to see what is going on. And there are specific machines that do what's known as cone down views or spot imaging of that area of the breast. And that's just the process of the screening program, right? So they're screening, the initial thing found little something. So they go now to the next device to see if that truly represents anything that is worrisome. And if that turns out, unfortunately, to be that, they will then automatically refer you for the further assessment to be done to determine exactly what's going on. It doesn't usually go any faster because it's part of the screening process, unless there was some really overt change that made it almost impossible to say that it was not cancer. So if they're sending you for this other test, it means they're just not sure yet, and they need to do this test to figure it out. And if so, waiting the few weeks will not change anything. Even as I said, if this is cancer, waiting a few weeks does not change the outcome. Although it's certainly on a person's mind when that happens, and that is the only conundrum. But this is a very common approach to evaluating, and you will get an answer fairly quickly. Sometimes it goes faster than the 2 weeks, depending on availability. But the wait time is not from a medical standpoint. The wait time is not onerous in terms of doing that evaluation. We're going to go to line two and speak to Mark in Barrhaven. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi, Dr. Dorkin. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Now, that last song you put on, I got to compliment you on your choice of songs in between breaks.
I know. Excellent.
And this last song, it's very fitting. I'm a 64-year-old man.
Yeah.
And I never used to have trouble sleeping.
Right.
For over 3 years now, I'll give you a typical scenario. I watch TV. I go to bed. It could be 11 o'clock. I sleep for a couple of hours. I could sleep for anywhere from 2 to 3 hours. I wake up. I can't get back to sleep. I come in my man cave.
Yeah.
I put the TV on or I put some music on. I'm back to sleep in 5 to 15 minutes.
Right.
I wake up 2 hours later, typically. I go back to bed. I sleep for the rest of the night. Or I go back to bed and I can't get back to sleep. I come back to the man cave, fall asleep, go back in a sort of a vicious cycle.
Sure.
I have tried gummy bears. I have tried CBD oil. I have tried melatonin. And I was tested several years ago for sleep apnea, and I was a borderline case.
Right.
I've been trying to find doctors, you know, and everybody wants to do a sleep apnea test. Well, I'm not interested in a sleep apnea test. I was borderline. I used the machine for a few weeks, and I didn't get any benefit from it whatsoever. Have you seen this before?
Yeah, sleep problems are very common. There can be a whole host of reasons for that. I mean, our brains change also as we get older. And so as we get older, our sleep patterns can get disrupted.
Yeah.
Brain patterns can get disrupted. So when doing a sleep test, what they're looking for, and it's not a sleep apnea test, because a referral will be made to a physician who specializes in sleep disorders.
Okay.
But what they're looking for is the phases of sleep that you're going through. Are you getting the deep sleep? Or is there an interruption between the light sleep stages, the first two stages, and the deeper sleep stages? Are you getting restorative sleep? How many hours a night are you in a REM state or a dream state?
Right.
All those things can help determine if there has been a disruption in the normal cycle.
Right.
On the basis of that, they can make determinations on how to treat that.
Okay.
So it is important to do that. So yes, it's and the fact that you can fall back asleep is important because it tells us that that mechanism is working well.
Right.
But if you're waking up in the middle of the night, usually if you're in deep sleep states, you just don't wake up. That's the kind of thing where, you know, if you're aroused when you're in a deep sleep and you're woken up, it feels like there's a gong going off in your head, right? You're disoriented and stuff because you're in a very deep sleep. But if you're waking up and you're sort of up, then you were in very light sleep, and that can indicate that you're not going into those stages as many times as you should.
Right.
And so that's where you need to have the hard data to see how that's happening.
Gotcha. You know, the other thing, I used to sleep on my right side.
Yeah.
I don't anymore. It's not comfortable. I can't do it. I get restless. I have to go to the other side.
Yeah.
And I did that for years. This is I'm going back maybe around the same time that the sleep problems have sort of started.
We like to think that we are static individuals, right? That nothing changes, that everything stays the same. You know, yeah. Our brains think that we're 25, but yeah. Our bodies tell us that we are not.
Yeah.
So you see these changes and it gets frustrating because you go, well, I don't feel any different. I'm feeling okay. Why is this happening? It's because the brain cells are 64 years old now and not 25 years old. So
right,
there are
right.
things that happen that we have no control over per se, but there right. usually are ways. And the tendency is to avoid medications for sleep because all yeah. that does is create a dependency
yeah.
and further disrupts that whole cycle even more.
Right. Can you recommend a place I go to or a doctor or organization I go to?
Yeah, there are. If you just look up sleep labs in Ottawa, your family. Do you have a family doctor?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. So your family doctor usually makes that referral for you. So there's
right.
a couple of sleep labs. There's one in the West End. It's called okay. the West Ottawa Sleep Center. There's at the hospital itself. There's a whole bunch of sleep places around town, and they will be able to help you. But your physician has to make that appointment for you. And
right.
there's also some blood tests that are usually done because sometimes there are some metabolic things that happen that can disrupt sleep as well.
Right, right. Perfect. Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And keep that good music coming.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. Got a question here. I'm vaccinated against the measles as a child. I'm now 68 years old. Do I need a booster shot? Thank you. So the recommendations are that if you had one shot, and you were born before 1970, you're okay. So the answer is no, you don't need the second shot. If you had one shot and you were born after 1970, then they recommend the second shot. So that's sort of the answer to that question. We're going to go to line three and speak to Patrick. Hi, Patrick.
Oh, hi, doctor.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. I get this phone straightened out.
Okay.
I've been taking Metamucil for the last few months.
Right.
And my question is I take it every morning, apparently around 4:30 in the morning. I take three of the gummy bears every day.
Right.
And things are working out fine as far as they go. Is there any problem taking this stuff all the time?
No, Metamucil is a fiber-like product. So it's
yes.
not a medication per se. It's designed to help absorb water and bulk up stool so that you're able to go to the bathroom regularly. And there's no problem doing that. It doesn't affect the bowel. It's not a laxative in terms of a stimulative laxative. There are laxatives that can stimulate the bowel to contract, and those are the ones that your bowel can get used to and you end up with a sort of a lazy bowel. There are others that absorb water. So Metamucil is one of those where it's a fiber. And that has no effect on the intestine at all. It's simply how it is absorbing water. That's all it does.
So
Metamucil you can take pretty much forever, and it won't cause any harm, provided, and the caveat to this is provided you have adequate water intake.
Yeah, I drink quite a bit of water. I always have water with me anyway. And
right, because the reason is if you have something that is absorbing water in the intestine, and you're not taking enough water, then what happens is you get concrete.
Oh my.
And that's not
yeah,
good.
Don't want
so
that.
you need to have enough water so that it actually works.
Yeah, I drink lots of water.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Patrick.
All right.
All the best to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Gonna take a small break and come back with your calls and questions. I'm Dr. Barry DeWorken, and you're listening to House Calls. Back in a couple of minutes.
was a hit before your mother was born. Though she was born a long, long time ago, your mother should know.
Your mother should know.
Sing it again. Let's all get up and dance to a song that was a hit.
Welcome back. I'm going to go to line one and speak to Nancy in the PN. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to ask you a quick question.
Sure.
I'm 71. I never had a vaccine for measles as a baby.
Right.
And in grade three, I got MS, which nobody knew, and I didn't know, of course. And it has progressed, like MS does. But the thing I'm worried about now is, should I get a vaccine for measles? Now, when I was 8, I also got measles, the red measles from...
Right, you had rubella.
Pardon me?
You had rubella.
No, I had measles.
Yeah, you said if you had red measles, that's rubella.
No, it wasn't red.
Okay.
It was the German red measles.
Right, okay.
That were going around at the time. Anyway, and I just wonder, do I need a vaccine?
So there are two ways to approach this. One is to get a blood test to find out, or just speak to your physician and just get the vaccine, right? So there are, because if it's unknown and it's unsure whether you had measles or not.
Oh, I had the measles.
So if you had measles, then you don't need the vaccine.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the only thing I was worried about. If you had it, you don't need it, right?
Yeah, so if you were born before 1970 and measles was really around quite a bit in the 60s to 70s,
that's it, yeah.
Then it confers immunity.
Great.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted to bother you with.
That's okay, Nancy. Bye. You're not bothering. It's no problem.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now.
Okay,
so I'm going to get through some of the comments here. Recently diagnosed type 2 diabetes and first-time mom in early pregnancy. A1C is 6.4%, so that actually is still pre-diabetic. Diabetes is 6.5%, but that's close. Can you talk about blood glucose targets and what the prognosis is with type 2 and pregnancy? So if you're in early pregnancy and you have type 2 diabetes, usually this is controlled by diet. Usually will be referred to the diabetes center, part of the obstetrics program at the hospital, just for people to follow. The target range is to keep the A1C below 7% and have tight control. It's also ensuring that in terms of pregnancy, that weight gain is appropriate, but not more than it should be, because the weight itself is a contributing factor with the weight gain during pregnancy. The normal weight gain, blood sugar levels can go up. And part of the problem is that elevated blood sugar levels have an effect on the growing fetus. It can cause a condition called macrosomia, macro meaning large, somia is body. So it's a large body where the heads can be larger, tongues can be larger. So it causes some changes to the baby just from excessive growth. And so the idea is obviously to prevent that from happening, and usually is very well managed. There are other things that can be used if necessary, but most of the time dietary approaches are used first and with appropriate follow-up, and they will be monitoring you. They will be able to ensure that the pregnancy proceeds without any undue harm to the baby. So that's pretty much what it is. The goal, again, is just to keep the sugars as low as possible, but usually below 7% for the A1C is the target range. Lower is obviously going to be better with tighter sugar control. And usually your physician will make a referral for you if you're not seeing an OB right now, make a referral for you to the center that reviews this and helps women who are pregnant who also have a diagnosis of diabetes. With respect to this resurgence, this is Maria in Ottawa. Respect to resurgence of measles, I'm trying to understand why this has become such a concern in the West when a majority of the population have been either vaccinated or had it in childhood. Babies and children are vaccinated in the early years and can't attend schools unless they are up to date, and then boosters. So we're looking at a new strain of measles who is getting infected now and who's at risk. It's the unvaccinated that are getting infected. It's because vaccination rates have gone down. 95% of the population needs to be vaccinated to pretty much eradicate measles. We are not at that. In some 79% of all children 7 years of age and younger have only had two vaccines, have had only one vaccine, and so they are not as protected. There are pockets in the country. So Waterloo area has an 85% vaccination rate. So vaccination rates are not where they are, and that's why you're seeing a resurgence. It is a simple A to B correlation. Less vaccination, more measles. More vaccination, less measles. So it's not a new strain, but it is a growing problem because of the reduction in vaccinating children. A lot of children, again, if they're 7 years old, haven't had their second dose. And I guess because of COVID and public health strain, there hasn't been as much checking up to see if they received their second dose. But ultimately, that's the reason for that. Another person writes, just wondering about the preparations for colonoscopy. What is the difference between the jug of preparation and the pouches that get mixed with water? So what you're talking about is lactulose is the stuff that you drink. That's a lot of stuff to drink. All of them work by increasing the amount of water that is retained in the intestine. So there's the lactulose, but there's also something called picosalix, which is the pouches, orange-flavored things. They accomplish the same thing. They're more concentrated, but and so that's really the difference between them. My preference when I'm for someone who's otherwise healthy that has no kidney problems is to use the picosalix because it's a lot easier than drinking 4 liters of the lactulose. But you do have to drink a lot of water, though, if you're using the picosalix. So the pouches, you take that. Usually it's twice in a day. So you take it in the morning and then again at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the day before you go for your colonoscopy. Tends to work a little bit more gentler on your bowel, but you do have to drink water to use it. So that's the difference between them. It's just how it's prepared. In this case, you're drinking the water itself, and then you've taken that pouch and drank a small amount, but the water mixes in obviously with it and helps it work. Whereas the other one, the lactulose, is simply all the water and the medication together diluted into it. So that's sort of what that is. So that's sort of the difference between that. Now, I did get something from Kevin in Petawawa, and Kevin, I was on the floor with this. It's called iTetraCare Frequency Wand, and I looked this up. It's a device. It's amazing when you go to the home screen. Everybody loves Einstein. So it says here, future medicine will be the medicine of frequencies. What this device does, it says here, terahertz resonates at the same frequency as normal human cells. Okay. Generating millions of vibrations per second. Don't know what that actually means in terms of your cells. They basically say when the human body is exposed to terahertz frequency, it can rapidly transfer energy to the cells and activate them. Well, as far as I know, your cell's energy source doesn't come from the terahertz frequencies. It comes from the mitochondria, which are in your cells, which are the little energy factories that produce the energy for your cells. The cells themselves don't necessarily vibrate at terahertz frequencies, although I guess you can get all a quiver when that happens when you use a device. The device costs $4,000, and when I looked up the science of it, right, because on their website they review the science, and it basically says they talk about the atoms and the same language that I talked about earlier in the show about the ripronator and the frequencies and quantum mechanics and neutrons and energy and the flow of electrons and all this stuff. What a load of horse hockey. So don't spend $4,000 on a device that is designed to make your body shake and rattle and roll. Just let your cells do what they're supposed to do. They're programmed to do it. They don't need any help to do that at all. That about wraps up the show. My thanks to Stephen Ellsworth for producing Sunday House Call. Your comments and questions, terrific. Very happy that you're participating in the show. I love it. And we'll be back next week with another edition of House Calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.
Everything is beautiful in its own way. Like a starry summer night or a snow-covered winter's day. And everybody's beautiful.